Monday morning you sure look fine. Good morning, NFL fans. Welcome to another episode of Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. I'm your host, Dave Holcomb. Boy, do we have a full show for you today. Week two of the NFL season's pretty much over. We still have the Monday night game, which should be an exciting one as of this recording. Anyway, we still have the Monday night game between the Eagles and Colts. But the other 15 games, 30 other teams have already played, and to sum it up in one sentence, in one phrase, what this week has been like around the NFL, it is the week from hell. It's just been crazy, absolutely ridiculous what is going on off the field, away from the games. And unfortunately, a good portion of our show today is going to be dedicated a lot of the time is allocated to those stories, which are very important stories. Don't get me wrong. But unfortunately, we won't be talking about all the great games that happened on Thursday and then through the weekend on Sunday. But today we will start with Sunday Night Football, the Chicago Bears getting a victory on the road against a very tough San Francisco team. That is our leading story. In our second segment, we will get to those off-the-field issues that happened over the course of the week in the hell week the NFL experienced this past week. Ray Rice, obviously the video has been released on him hitting his fiance, now wife. Everybody who is a football fan, anybody who has a computer, as a smartphone, has seen the video. Actually, I don't have a smartphone, and I've seen the video. So everybody has seen this, and that's probably not what we're going to concentrate mostly on in our topic about that. But I have a video to play from ESPN reporter, actually ESPN anchor Hannah Storm, and her take on it. And I will give you kind of my take kind of building on what points she made in her kind of two-minute spiel about where the NFL is going with Ray Rice and all the news that came out this week. And then we will also talk about Adrian Peterson. I'll play you another video, this time from Chris Carter on ESPN's Sunday morning countdown, NFL countdown on Sunday morning. And what he had to say about Peterson and child abuse in general. Normally, I don't like to reference ESPN as sources on this show. I'm not a huge fan of their reporting. That is an understatement. But I think these two videos are really great and can shed some light on both cases, Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson. We'll also have a segment dedicated just to injuries. We don't do that a lot on this show, but there were a lot of guys going down in the games on Sunday. And then in our fourth and long segment, we'll cap off the show talking about Richard Sherman and his lack of words after the Seahawks lost to the Chargers 30-21 on Sunday. A weird case of where a timeout did not benefit the team that asked for it. You know, you see something new every week in the league, and I guess this was the new thing this week. The offensive coordinator for the Jets asked for a timeout, and it was not granted to him until after the play was run, and on that play, the Jets scored a touchdown, but that touchdown was nullified, so we'll talk about that. And also, the division rival of the Jets, the Buffalo Bills, they're 2-0. They won their home opener over the Miami Dolphins in great fashion, blowout fashion. We'll talk about the Bills in our fourth and long segment as well. But I want to start with the team that actually the Bills knocked off in their first victory last week, the Chicago Bears, bouncing back in a big way, coming back to erase a 17-point deficit and defeat one of the elite teams in the conference, that is the San Francisco 49ers. I'm going to run through the Bears' stats here, on offense anyway, to start off our discussion here. On offense, the Bears ran 52 plays, gained 216 yards on offense. Okay, now that's not very many plays. That's not very many yards. 170 passing yards, 46 rushing yards. 46 rushing yards. They had 34 pass attempts versus 17 rush attempts. They did not stay balanced, like Jay Cutler told NBC before the game that they would. Without the or without a completely healthy Alshon Jeffrey and Brandon Marshall, the Bears felt like it was important to establish a running game with Matt Forte and hit Martellus Bennett, the tight end, in the passing game. They hit Bennett for some big plays, but Forte did virtually nothing in this game. Forte's final stat line, 12 carries, 21 yards. That's 1.8 yards per carry. As I said, the big guns on the ends, the targets for Jay Cutler, Brandon Marshall, and Alshon Jeffrey both nursing injuries. Didn't know until about an hour or two before the game if either one would suit up. Both were in uniform, but not themselves at all. And over the course of this game on defense, the Bears lost Jay Ratliff, Charles Tillman, Chris Conte, and Sherrick McManus. They lost three defensive backs, and they still won this game by a score of 28-20. How did they do it? Well, it helps when you get four turnovers, and Colin Kaepernick by himself turned the ball over four times on Sunday night. He threw three interceptions and fumbled, and as much as you want to, as people could concentrate on Kaepernick giving the ball away, you know, giveaways for the defense are called takeaways. All right, there's the obvious statement of the day. The Bears took away the ball. This looked like an old Bears defense from, say, the mid-2000s with Lovie Smith as their head coach. They were taking away the ball, going for the strip, which they got Kaepernick once on, and making dynamic plays in the secondary despite not having three key guys, especially Charles Tillman, the replacement for Tillman. Kyle Fuller, the rookie out of Virginia Tech, had two of the interceptions, both in the fourth quarter. Chris Conte got the other one in the first half before he exited. But Kyle Fuller coming up with the two big picks was huge in this game. The first one was a tremendous pass defense. He had blanketed the receiver, and it looked like he was just going to knock the ball away. It turned out that he got his arm into a position where he was able to grab the ball, and before you knew it, he had it. He had possession of it and got up and started running towards the end zone. Did not make it to the end zone, but he set up the go-ahead score. At that point in time, the Bears had all the momentum in the game, and Fuller's interception there led to one play later, Jay Cutler finding Brandon Marshall in the end zone for a touchdown, and the Bears finally led in this game 21-20. On the next possession, Fuller intercepts Kaepernick again, left his man this time that he was covering to go cut off a pass that was intended for Derek Carrier, and the Bears scored another touchdown on their next offensive drive. That's how you win games with only gaining, you know, 216 yards on offense. You have short fields. And on three or four occasions in this game, really on all four occasions where they scored touchdowns, they had short fields. Now, I do have to say, as great as the Bears' defense was in this game, they could not have won it without the heroics of quarterback Jay Cutler and the two wideouts I mentioned that were not 100%, Jeffries and Marshall. Marshall made a tremendous one-handed catch for the Bears' first touchdown. That was late in the first quarter. The Bears were trailing 17-0 at that point. That got the Bears on the board. It was something to hold their hats on going into halftime. They still trailed by 10, and the 49ers were getting the ball coming out of half. But it was something to build hope on. And then Marshall ended up catching the other two touchdown passes. Two of the other three touchdown passes from Jay Cutler. Cutler throwing a total of four touchdown passes in this game. Without the defense, of course, the Bears could not have won this. But Cutler converted those opportunities into touchdowns, not settling for field goals. And even more importantly, not turning the ball over like his counterpart quarterback Kaepernick did in this game. early on, Cutler was trying to hit Jeffrey and Marshall on short passing routes that the 49ers cornerbacks are really sitting on because they knew about the injuries that Marshall and Jeffrey weren't going to beat them over the top. But you have to commend the Bears offense and Cutler for making the adjustment. They started using their bodies and throwing jump balls to Marshall and Jeffrey. And in particular, on that first touchdown, that was a jump ball that Marshall got up and made a tremendous one-handed catch on. Maybe the best catch of week two. Mike Wallace had a great catch for a touchdown against the Bills as well, a one-handed catch. But Marshall's was tremendous. And again, that gave them momentum going into the half. And that kind of gave Cutler a blueprint for what to do in the second half going forward, trying to throw different kinds of balls, jump balls, or throwing it in a position where they can box out the defender using their bodies rather than having to use their speed on a night that they were injured. The 49ers defense from the start was basically saying to the Bears, go ahead and throw it. You're not going to beat us with Matt Forte. Like I said, he averaged less than 2 yards in this game. Unfortunately, it backfired for San Francisco. Jay Cutler made the throws. Marshall and Jeffrey were healthy, just healthy enough to make the plays to win this one. 4 touchdowns from Cutler, even though he only threw for 176 yards. And again, the most important stat, did not turn the ball over. As for the 49ers, they shot themselves in the foot all game. They spoiled their home opener for their beautiful new stadium in Santa Clara. Kaepernick had the 4 turnovers. He did have a decent game, 21 of 34, 248 yards, and had 9 carries for 66 yards. But again, got to take care of the ball. Frank Gore, 13 carries, 63 yards. Michael Crabtree had a nice bounce back game after not being involved last week. 7 receptions, 82 yards, and a touchdown, the first score in the brand new stadium. But in addition to the turnovers, penalties absolutely killed San Francisco in this one. 16 accepted penalties against the 49ers for 118 yards. And the one that sticks out most in my mind, in the second half, starting out the third quarter, this to me is where the game really turned in Chicago's favor. The 49ers had a first and goal at the 6-yard line. On the next 3 plays, they ran Gore for a 1-yard gain. Carlos Hyde lost 2 yards on second and goal. And then Gore ran again and gained 1 yard in a shotgun formation. The 49ers had to settle for a field goal. They extended the lead to 20-7. But ultimately at that point, with the Bears scoring at the end of the first half, and the 49ers with the ball, driving, and having the ball for over 9 minutes to start the second half, that was a victory for the Bears, holding them to a field goal. Rather than having it be, again, a 3-possession game, it remained just 2 possessions at 20-7. You could tell on the face of Jim Harbaugh that that was a moral victory for the Bears because he was disappointed he had to send out the field goal unit. On the next Bears offensive possession, the 49ers actually forced a 3-and-out, which would have been huge because the Bears offense was going to go right off the field, or the Bears defense was going right back on the field after being out there for over 9 minutes. But a penalty, illegal hands to the face on 3rd down, extended that drive. The Bears scored a touchdown. And the momentum from there completely shifted as the game was now 20-14, and Kaepernick at that point started coughing up the ball. There've been a tremendous amount of discussions about the penalties and the new emphasis of the rules this year. And look, I don't like it. Okay, I think the NFL is getting soft. I've been saying that for years that it's been getting soft, but I'm going to take a different stance on this one. These penalties, these new emphasis on the rules, it is what it is. And the 49ers, like every other team in the league, have to deal with it. And they didn't deal with it on Sunday night. If you want to continue to win, if you're Jim Harbaugh and you want to continue to win and get back to the NFC Championship game and ultimately win the Super Bowl, you have to learn how to play with these new rules. It's as simple as that. You're not going to win many games with 16 accepted penalties and over 100 yards in penalties. That is not a winning formula, along with turning the ball over four times. We're going to take our first break here on Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle, but when we come back, we're going off the field discussing the Ray Rice scandal and Adrian Peterson's indictment this week. Welcome back to Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. I'm your host, Dave Holcomb. Don't forget, I want you to be involved on the show. Send me what you think about the show or any comments you have about the NFL. We'll get you on the air. Tweet at me, DM, HOLCOMB. Send me an email, holcombmdavid@gmail.com. You can also reach me on Facebook, Dave's Football News. Now, unfortunately, we're going off the field on this one. Again, I can't stress enough how important these two stories are. They're very important, not just for the NFL, but for our American society and society in general, our world. But I'm just disappointed that we can't talk more about the games because I don't want to extend the length of the show at all. I want to get you out here in about 45 minutes. And I'm disappointed that we can't spend the entire time talking about what happened on the field because every week there's tremendous stories on the field. But we have to talk about Ray Rice and we have to talk about Adrian Peterson because they are extremely important. So to open up our discussion on these two topics, I have a video from ESPN. It's their anchor Hannah Storm talking about specifically Ray Rice, but really the NFL in general and the moral conscience that the NFL has had this week, or lack thereof, of the idea of morals in the NFL. And this came out before what came out about Adrian Peterson on Thursday. So it still kind of applies to both, but this was almost a statement, a rant, if you will, that Storm goes on even before the Peterson news came out. So I'm going to play this video right now of you, Hannah Storm from ESPN.
Long fan and a mother of three daughters. On Monday morning, I was genuinely excited to come to work and break down what I thought was a fascinating first weekend in the NFL. Instead, I kicked off ESPN's coverage of the horrific Ray Rice elevator video. Meanwhile, one of my daughters has her first fantasy football team this season. But at breakfast this week, instead of discussing how her team was doing, we watched the Ray Rice video play out again in all its ugliness. I spent this week answering seemingly impossible questions about the league's biggest stars. Mom, why did he do that? Why is he in jail? Why didn't he get fired? And yesterday, why don't they even have control of their own players? So here's a question. What does all of this mean for the future? What does it mean for female fans whose dollars are so coveted by the NFL, who make up an estimated 45% of the NFL's fan base? Are fans and our families, are we as parents, supposed to compartmentalize everything that's happening? Are we supposed to simply separate a violent game on the field from violent acts off the field? And if we do, what message does that send? So here are some more questions. What exactly does zero tolerance mean to the NFL? What does it mean to the coaches, the GMs, the owners? What about the NFLPA? Will the NFL, in all its power, take the lead on the issue of domestic violence? In the NFL, apparently seeing is believing. If the NFL and the Ravens had to see that video to be moved to significant action, then shouldn't those who support the league demand the same, to see action, to see change before believing, as we all wait on the answer to this central question? What exactly does the NFL stand for? NFL countdown.
As you may be able to tell, and again, you can find that video if you want to watch it again on usatoday.com or just Google search Hannah Storm, and probably will come up if you just Google search her name, but you know, Google search her name with Ray Rice or NFL video, whatever. I'm sure it'll come up. If you can tell by the tone of her voice just in the audio, she was on the verge of crying. It was a very emotional story for her, obviously, and actually I think it was very moving in the way it was delivered, which, again, I don't normally like the way ESPN delivers their news, but not that that was news, it was an opinion, but I think it was very moving in the way it was delivered. And the most important thing that she says there is, what does no tolerance actually mean? Now, it got better as the week went. We saw Adrian Peterson get deactivated. Ray Rice was released and indefinitely suspended. The Greg Hardy, the defensive end for the Carolina Panthers, he was deactivated. He did not play on Sunday. But Ray McDonald is still playing. And going forward, I mean, what does it mean for the NFL? I think that is a great question. And again, we want to hear what you think it means for the NFL going forward. Tweet at me, DM, HOLCOMB. But the latest with the Ray Rice incident, scandal, whatever you want to call it. Monday, Ray Rice plans to appeal his indefinite suspension, according to NFL Pro Football Talk. And you know what? I hate to say this. I don't want to be accused of defending Ray Rice, but you know what? He has a legitimate argument here. He is being suspended twice for the same act. According to Rice, he gave the NFL all the information that they would need to hand out the proper suspension, the proper punishment. And Goodell thought that proper punishment was two games. Obviously wrong. But in many ways, by suspending him indefinitely after you've already suspended him two games, isn't that kind of double jeopardy? Again, I don't want to be accused of defending Ray Rice. I in no way am saying he deserves to play this season. He should be suspended. But this just reaffirms how botched this whole situation has been by Roger Goodell, because I really believe that Rice has a legitimate chance of winning this and then having the chance to play this year. Will any team sign him? I don't know. Will any team actually put him in uniform on the field? I don't know, but Ray McDonald's still out there. You can return to Hannah Storm's question. What does no tolerance mean? Probably means something different to me than it does to you, than it does to the 49ers, than it does to the Carolina Panthers, and to each team out there. If there's a team out there that needs a running back and Ray Rice isn't indefinitely suspended and it's appealed, they could take a chance on him. And that is wrong, because Goodell messed this all up. He really screwed the pooch here. Because everybody wants to focus on the fact, did Goodell have the video or not? That is irrelevant. It is an irrelevant fact. He either had the video and knew all the details of it and still only gave out a two-game suspension, which is just appalling if that is the case. Or the alternative is he didn't care enough to actually investigate or acquire the video. And he can hide behind the fact of, oh, you know, the legal system didn't want to give it to us, and that would be going behind their back to try and find it. You don't think the NFL goes behind people's backs to acquire information that they want? If Goodell didn't get this information, if he didn't get the video, then he didn't care. Then he didn't want to get it. It wasn't important enough to him to actually find it and make a stand on domestic violence. And then he hides behind, we have a no tolerance policy. It is for that reason I truly believe, along with many others at this point in where we are with all of this, that Roger Goodell should lose his job. He should no longer be the NFL commissioner. He has lost the right to rule, to hand out punishments, suspensions. And quite frankly, if you don't want it to be a moral obligation to get rid of him, he's costing the NFL money. If I'm an NFL owner, I'm losing my audience and my dollars, my business, because consumers are being turned away from our game because of all the bad stuff that you indirectly helped contribute to. If you haven't gotten enough of me ranting and discussing Roger Goodell and why he should lose his job, go check out my article I wrote last week about Ray Rice and Roger Goodell. Rice being ousted by the NFL this year, and Goodell, the same should happen to him. Moving on to the Adrian Peterson indictment of child abuse that came out on Friday. This is a little bit tougher for me to pass judgment on. I don't have as strong of an opinion on this, I will admit, as I do on the Ray Rice scenario. Because I do think to a certain degree, you have to respect someone else's cultures. Now, in no way am I defending child abuse. I have no tolerance for child abuse. I'm only laughing because that phrase has been made a joke by the NFL. But Charles Barkley came on NFL Today on CBS on Sunday, and with Jim Rome, they had a back and forth discussion about the differences in culture and race and the danger of trying to tell somebody that they can't raise their kids in a certain way. And Barkley basically said that in his family and in his neighborhood, that if everybody that was disciplining their children got arrested, thrown in jail, indicted, whatever, everybody in his neighborhood then would be in jail. And Jim Rome came back and said, well, you know, this is not 1964, this is 2014, which is a legitimate point. But I don't want to say I agree with Barkley. He made it about race, he made it about the culture of the South, he made it about blacks and how they raise their children. I do, in a way, agree that you can't tell someone how to raise their kids to a certain degree. If they are blatantly abusing their children, of course you step in and stop that. But then the case and discussion then points to, did Peterson go too far in what he did? And that is a whole nother discussion that we could have. But you know what? I found another video in addition to the Barkley Rome video. And it's of Chris Carter on NFL Sunday Countdown on Sunday before the games happened. What Carter had to say during that roundtable discussion about Peterson really struck me. Another really moving video. You can find that on usatoday.com or just Google search Chris Carter. Chris Carter, powerful speech on Adrian Peterson, it'll come up. If you just Google Chris Carter, probably will come up. Even more moving than the first video, really. And what he says in that last part, with the only thing that you can do, the only thing that football players and men respect is the game and playing. And that is what you have to take away from them in order to make change. I don't disagree with Peterson being inactive. And I think Carter and what he started that discussion with, the fact that relating it to himself and saying no matter what race you are, no matter what culture you are, religious background, whatever, in the day and age that we're in now, you cannot hit a child. The same way that you can't hit a woman. You can't, if you're a man, you can't hit either a child or a woman. It's unacceptable. And I can go on and repeat myself, but I think Carter said it so simply and so perfectly that we're just going to end on that. We're moving into injuries now. I want to name several big guys that went down. You know, if you missed some of the games, maybe you didn't see these big guys go down, or maybe it's important for your fantasy teams, fantasy matchups in the future. And if you don't have these players, know who their backups are. Go pick up their backups. Let's start with Sunday night. Vernon Davis left Sunday night's loss to the Bears for the 49ers with an ankle injury. He did not return. It might be a high ankle sprain at this point. That means he will miss multiple weeks. Jamal Charles left with an ankle sprain as well against the Broncos, but that is believed to be a minor injury. Ryan Matthews had a sprained knee, sprained MCL, could be out a while. The Chargers' bye week is until week 10, so that tells me that the Chargers were kind of hoping their bye week would be earlier so that Matthews wouldn't miss the whole schedule, that they could even catch a break and not have him miss 1 week. But he'll probably be back around week 10 or before that, and then not play that week because that's when their bye is. But anyway, that tells me that is a pretty significant injury, sprained to his knee. RG3, this is a pretty significant injury. Dislocated ankle. He will be out 4 to 5 weeks. Kirk Cousins came in and played very well, though. The Redskins won 41-10 over the Jaguars. AJ Green was dealing with the toe injury all week. It was reported as a foot injury, but it came out Sunday. It was actually his toe. He has turf toe, which doesn't sound that intimidating, but it actually is very painful. He probably will sit out one game. The Bengals have a bye in week 4. So the idea behind that is Green sits out this coming week and then gets an extra week off because of the bye, comes back completely healthy week 5. I think is the only defensive player on this list for the Kansas City Chiefs. Another injury for that defense. It's really going to hurt them in their playoff hopes. Eric Berry, sprained ankle. He left in the first half, could not return against the Broncos. Another Eric. Eric Decker, hamstring injury. He caught 4 passes for 63 yards and a touchdown before he left. Did not return. Was disappointing because he was on his way to a very nice game against the Packers. And another one for the Redskins, DeSean Jackson, left with a sprained AC joint, but he's listed as day-to-day, so one of the more minor injuries that we just ran through. All right, we're due for another break here on Monday Morning Huddle. A lot to comprehend. Hope you can do that while you listen to another AC/DC song. We'll come back with the 4th and Long segment. And we're back here on Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. I'm your host, Dave Holcomb. Don't forget, tweet at me, DM, HOLCOMB. Send me an email, holcombmdavid@gmail.com. Find me on Facebook, Dave's Football News. Let's get into our 4th and Long segment. We got 3 statements here. If you're new to the show, I'm either going to agree and grunt on that statement or disagree and punt. Here we go. The Super Bowl champs, Seattle Seahawks, lost to the San Diego Chargers on Sunday, 30-21. And Richard Sherman, not too happy about it. Actually, so depressed about it, he didn't have anything to say to the media after the game, which is really surprising if you fans out there know who Richard Sherman is. He really likes to talk. So him not talking to the media was a big surprise. And my statement here, Richard Sherman did not talk to the media not talking to the media after the game was the right decision if he was frustrated about it. Absolutely not. I'm punting that away. Surprisingly, I really like Richard Sherman. So I want to preface this statement and then this discussion with that fact that I find myself defending him a lot. But in this case, I can't defend him. I understand that he expects the best out of himself and the best out of his team. And his swagger is something that you could really admire. Even if it rubs you the wrong way sometimes, it's something that you can admire. But there's nothing wrong with admitting that you had a bad day. It happens to everyone. Everybody has bad games. There's nothing wrong with a little humility. And that is what Sherman seems to not understand. That he doesn't want to appear weak in front of the media or talk to them after a bad game or a loss. I think it's important to Sherman to be popular and to have people understand what he's all about. If he didn't care what people thought about him, he wouldn't have had a long press conference after his long or very short and loud post-game interview on the field at the NFC Championship game. It was important enough to not come across as a thug. So I think it's safe to say that Sherman, at some degree, likes people to like him, wants people to like him, and be his fan. So I don't understand why he doesn't realize that coming across more as a common man and being a little bit humble would actually make him a little bit more popular and then get him more attention than pushing off the media and ignoring them. But what's another interesting fact of this story is the Chargers wide receiver Keenan Allen had some comments for the media, as Sherman did not have any after the game. And Allen said, "All week we said we were going to throw at him because he's not what he's hyped up to be." And he also added in his quotes that he loves going up against the best. And when he said the best, he made the air quote signs with the fingers. And then he said, "I just went out and played my game." There's a really good USA Today article breaking this whole thing down, and I really completely agree with what the article was saying. I mean, it's easy for Allen to talk some trash now to Richard Sherman because the Chargers won, and unless the two teams make it to the Super Bowl in the same year, Allen is not going to be lined up against Richard Sherman again for 4 years. "Oh yeah, you're a real man, Allen, talking trash to somebody who won't play again for another half decade." But what I don't understand is Sherman had nothing to say to the media after the game, but then he went on Twitter and tweeted, "LMAO, exposed, ... ... complete 3 passes, 0 touchdowns, 0 explosive passes, ... these guys make me laugh." And that is all true. Sherman didn't play all that bad. When I said it's humbling, it's nice to see a player humble himself after a bad game. Well, Sherman didn't even have that bad of a game. Rivers threw in his direction a lot, but he only completed 3 passes to a wide receiver that was going up against Sherman. So Sherman is right. He wasn't exposed. You know, he didn't have a perfect game and the Seahawks lost, but completing 3 passes against Sherman by no means is a huge surprise or accomplishment. But why didn't Sherman just say that to the media? Why didn't Sherman just say, you know, I didn't play all that bad. Why didn't he come across as brash and arrogant to the media rather than waiting to go on Twitter? To me, it comes across as being insecure. And he had to say that on Twitter and tweet it out. I don't know. I don't want to be accused. I don't want to accuse Sherman as being a coward, but it's a cowardly act to tweet it afterwards in front of a phone or a computer rather than saying it in front of a group of people. And of course, I say this borderline calling Sherman a coward while I broadcast a podcast in front of my computer. So look, if Sherman wants to come after me, you know, I'd love to have a discussion with him. Maybe he'll come on the show. but I don't understand that part of the story. It's very interesting, and in many ways I side with Sherman because what Allen said is ridiculous. Sherman is the best cornerback in the league. He is everything that he's been hyped up to be and more. But I don't get why Sherman wouldn't say that himself in front of the media after the game then. Okay, we got two more stories to get to, and I want to wrap up the show pretty quickly. So first, the New York Jets. My statement with the Jets calling a timeout that they – oh, man, this is just – where do you begin? My statement, though. The NFL should require referees to turn around and ensure that the head coach is actually the one calling for the timeout. There is a rule in the NFL that on the sideline, on the field, anyone can call a timeout. But on the sideline, only the head coach can be granted a timeout. On Sunday in the Jets-Packers game, the offensive coordinator, Marty Mordenweg, was calling for a timeout. Now, this is according to NJ.com, that Mordenweg was calling for a timeout. The referee just looked at him and didn't say anything. He can't give him the timeout. He's the offensive coordinator. Only the head coach can call for a timeout. But defensive player Sheldon Richardson saw that his offensive coordinator was calling for the timeout. He was standing behind the referee close to where Rex Ryan was. And he whispered in the referee's ear, timeout, timeout, timeout. The NFL, the referee granted the timeout, thinking that was Rex Ryan, blew the play dead, but wasn't able to blow the play dead before the play actually happened. It was 4th and 4 with 5:06 left in the game from the Packers' 37-yard line. The Jets going for it on 4th down. Geno Smith throws a perfect pass. I mean, probably his best pass of the day to Jeremy Curley for a touchdown. That was supposed to tie the game at 31, but the referee said, no, no, no. The Jets called a timeout. Rex Ryan is confused. I didn't call a timeout, but the referee thought he did. So I'm grunting. Yes, of course, I think referees should make a more conscious effort to see who is calling the timeout. Turn around and see who it is. Will that be a slight delay in the process of granting a timeout? Will that cause some issues with the fact that maybe a timeout doesn't get off before Smith hikes the ball? Possibly. But isn't that better than what we had on Sunday? The Jets, a defensive player calling for a timeout illegally and then hurt his team? It's like the Jets broke the rules and it didn't help them. Oh, it just I always say that the Jets are just a circus on this team, and I feel bad for Jet fans because they like I said last week, the Chargers find new ways to lose. I'd never seen this before in the NFL, and the Jets just find different ways, weird ways to lose a ball game, and it's got to really stink for that loyal Jet fan base. Want to get to the Buffalo Bills, and I really am sorry that we're going to shortchange the Bills, who are 2-0, so far this year. Again, I would have loved to have talked about the Bills, would have loved to have talked about the Chiefs and Broncos, the Lions and Panthers, some great matchups in the NFL this week, but we had to dedicate half the show to Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson. So, but I want to say one thing about the Bills and my statement. The Bills are on the rise in the AFC East. Well, that is a strong statement, and if I had to, I don't know, I'd probably go in the middle between grunting and punting on that one, but ultimately I think I'm going to grunt. I do see a lot of improvements with the Buffalo Bills, and what helps them out a lot, they're in a weak division and they're in a weak conference. It's only 2 weeks in, but maybe this is finally the year somebody dethrones the New England Patriots for the division. It's the Buffalo Bills' chance because this looks like it could be one of their best teams in a decade and a half. And they're also in a weak conference competing for a wild card spot. They were impressive on the road, stole a game in Chicago, and then at home won a division game against an opponent that could also be up there competing for the division if the Patriots actually do fall back a little bit in that AFC East. You also have to like C.J. Spiller and Sammy Watkins. They're developing very nicely against the Dolphins Sunday. Spiller, 12 carries, 69 yards. His long run was 47. He's a big splash play guy. You know, him with Fred Jackson is a great compliment because Jackson is that every down back still, even though he's on the wrong side of 30, he can still provide that steady offense production while Spiller provides the big plays. 47-yard run on Sunday and 102-yard kickoff return for a touchdown against the Dolphins. Sammy Watkins, same thing. Big plays. 8 catches, 117 yards, and a touchdown. 11 targets. E.J. Manuel targeted him 11 times. Nobody else on the team had more than 4 targets. Watkins had 11. That speaks volumes to the chemistry that those two already have. And you can't say enough about the defense and the special teams of the Bills. They've been excellent. Special teams getting a block, returning a kickoff for a touchdown against the Dolphins. Dan Carpenter's had a great season to start out, 5 for 6 against the Dolphins. But one thing that could hold them back, and it holds back every NFL team, the big question mark is still at quarterback, E.J. Manuel. On Sunday, he went 16 for 26, 202 yards, and a touchdown. Not terrible, but the Bills, like every other team, will go as far as their quarterback can take them. So the question really is for me about the Bills, if they're going to make some noise this year, can E.J. Manuel help them do that? Will he develop enough to allow the Bills to make some noise this year? Or is the team going to have to work around Manuel and other aspects of the team, the defense, the running game, the passing, the receiving game? Those are going to have to make up for the deficiency at quarterback in order to win 8, 9, 10 games and actually make it into the playoffs for the first time in however long it's been, 15, 16, 17 years for the Buffalo Bills. As AC/DC put it, it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll. Another song from AC/DC and that same album that song's from, High Voltage, and we'll be back right after this to wrap up today's show. Welcome back to Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. Your host, Dave Holcomb. One more reminder, give me a tweet, DM, HOLCOMB, an email, holcombmdavid@gmail.com, or find me on Facebook, Dave's Football News. Don't forget, I'd like you to check out my Ray Rice article talking about why Roger Goodell should be ousted from the NFL, just as Ray Rice was, although he may be back in it. We'll see in the next coming weeks how that appeal goes. Also want to remind you that throughout the season, I will be releasing power rankings every Tuesday morning. My number one or week one power rankings are already out, obviously, from last week. You can check those out. But week two will be coming out in a couple of days as of this recording. And two other articles by Vince Payne. Should Goodell be held to the same standards as players? And Bobby Renani, if that's how you say his last name. Sorry, Bobby, for butchering your name. His article called Why the Ray Rice Video Went Viral and the Big Ben Video Was Erased. That one, very catchy title. That title certainly got me to click. That's all we have for today. Until next time, I'm going to go try and find some peace in my mind.